This episode of Guitar Radio Show is brought to you in part by 2 of 3, the latest release from guitarist Steve Cone, is a true testament to rock guitar and how it should be played. From start to finish, a guitar tour de force you'll listen to over and over again. Steve Cone, 2 of 3, available at iTunes, Amazon, and CD Baby. Steve Cone, 2 of 3. DNA Guitars. Go to DNAGuitarCompany.com. Well, hey everybody, welcome to episode 110 of Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to all things guitar, dedicated to the guitar player, guitar builder, gear maker, and purveyors of such items that you may not know about, but you should. I'm your host, Mark Davin. Welcome to another episode. This is a great one, man. I'm so psyched. We've got Andy Powell of Wishbone Ash. He's got a new autobiography out, and it's quite good. It's a love letter to the road, but he doesn't hold back. It can be brutal. The road can be brutal, as some of us may know. So we're going to be talking to him about that today, and I think you're really going to enjoy that. Hey, thanks everybody for listening to the last episode with Joel Danzig. It was a rousing success, and we're thrilled that you all checked in, and we greatly appreciate it. Folks, go to guitarradioshow.com. You can email us at guitarradioshow@gmail.com. And for those of you who haven't gone back or had a chance to take a look at Adam's last blog, it was the history of the Flying V. You can go to guitarradioshow.com and find it right there. It was a good one. Lots of cool ones coming up, too. All right, hey, if you can hear the show on guitarradioshow.com, of course, iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Podbay, Podomatic, Player FM, iPod Directory, and streaming all over Europe. When you do, please, wherever you're listening to it, rate and review the show. That would be really cool. We'd greatly appreciate that. But be sure to check in at guitarradioshow.com because that's where the show notes are for that particular episode that you're listening to. All right? Let's see, what else I want to let you know about? We've got some real cool stuff coming up. We've got Tinsley Ellis coming up, Kelly Ritchie coming up, John Jorgensen from the Helicasters and beyond. So much more. Stoney Curtis coming up. And we've got a great gear show coming up real soon, too, with gear you should know that you might not. Well, that's it for business. Let's get into it. What do you say? Here's my interview with Andy Powell from Wishbone Ash. Guitar Radio Show. GuitarRadioShow.com. Well, you have our next guest to thank. There probably wouldn't, certain bands like Iron Maiden and Boston and Metallica might not sound the way they do if not for our next guest and his band Wishbone Ash. Andy Powell, welcome to Guitar Radio Show.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
You've got a new book out. It's an autobiography. And it's called Eyes Wide Open, True Tales of a Wishbone Ash Warrior.
Indeed I do, yeah.
And
yeah,
this...
so many people telling me I should put some of my stories down in print. And I mean, I've been in a band, and it's been in this band for 46 years. So, you know, I bow to the pressure. And I got to say, it was a very enlightening experience. You know, no small feat. It was a lot of work, and you know, because it's such a long career and it's so varied. So yeah, it was fun to do.
Yeah, it's almost 50 years now, isn't it?
It's insane. Yeah, I can't believe it.
Yeah, was doing this a catharsis for you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because you know, so much of the history was jumbled in my mind because, well, specifically the 70s, because from 69. Through till 1979, 1980, it was just one big party, and I was very young at the time, and so, you know, I would be doing these massive tours, one after another. The work ethic in this band has always been the main thing. That's why I called it True Tales of Wishbone Ash Warrior, because it's rather like going into battle with this band. I mean, we really do tour. I know a lot of bands tour, but I would say we are one of the preeminent touring bands. We play everywhere all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, even in those days, that's where I got the work ethic from. You know, things became very jumbled because we would go to endless tours of the United States, and some of these tours would last 9 or 10 weeks. And we would be just flying every day, flight after flight, day after day. And I was outside of New York and L.A., you know, you told me at night, Des Moines was on the West Coast, I'd have believed you in those days. I'd never clue where I was. So, you know, and of course, you know, illicit substances didn't make it any easier. And so I really had to, you know, cathartic, yeah, because I had to sort a lot of the dates out, a lot of the time frame, a lot of timeline. And so in that regard, it was just an amazing thing to actually take a deep breath and put my house in order.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, to be doing that for so long and still doing it.
Yeah.
Is there still as much get off in it now?
Well, you know, there are good times, there are bad times. I'm addicted to the kind of whole gypsy lifestyle. I love travel. For me, I'm never more happy when I'm traveling. I'm on the move. I do love to come home.
Mm-hmm.
But I do get itchy feet after a couple of weeks. You know, there's something about, even when I was a kid, and I say this in the book, you know, my mother always said, you know, I was one of those kids who would go in the backyard and always be looking over the fence to see what was going on over that fence. And that's kind of how I am. I'm always kind of living ahead of myself, which is kind of a bit of a bizarre trait. But so I, you know, what makes traveling work for me is that I'm always in the here and now. So, you know, if I learned a long, long time ago, I was even doing this as a teenager, playing in bands, but I realized that wherever I was, I would find a support system, and I'm always, like, right at home where I need to be, you know. So if I'm in Paris or I'm in Frankfurt or I'm in Des Moines, you know, I'll know people there. I'll be completely at one with my surroundings. I love hotels, you know, and I don't like shitty hotels, like good hotels. But I'm fine with that, you know. I like a clean set of sheets on the bed, fresh towels, I'm good to go, you know, and a suitcase. I don't know, I'm perfectly adjusted to it.
That's great. You are a true road dog.
Yeah, I am. I mean, unfortunately, yeah.
So in 1969, when Wishbone Ash got together, was it a preconceived notion, or was it something that over time and practice, it started to culminate?
Well, I think that there was a huge flowering in London. You know, I mean, the epicenter of music in many respects was in London at that time. So if you were in the business of getting in a band or forming a band or playing in a band, you knew that it was special, it was a privilege, and you knew if that was the game you were in, it had to be special. And there was this kind of zeitgeist with in the music industry, and as I say, the epicenter was London, that if you were doing that in London, and London was deemed to be the place that you went to get it together,
right,
perhaps more than any other city, that you really had to be putting something down that was specifically unique and different from the next guy down the block who was also forming a band. And that's how it was, you know. So, and, you know, there was this phrase all the time, you know, about making it. And, you know, we used to say, well, when we make it, and I know, to this day, I don't really know what making it is, but it was the phrase that was bandied around in the music game, in London, amongst musicians. You either made it or you didn't. Mm-hmm. You were either a winner or you were a loser. And it was like, it was even compounded by the fact that we had an American manager, and we were one of the first bands that Miles Copeland managed. We were the band probably that he cut his teeth on, you know, a well-known figure now as an entrepreneur in the music game. It went on to manage the Police and the Go-Go, you know, all these different bands, R.E.M. for a while. But, you know, he certainly learned all of his music business lessons with Wishbone Ash and all the experiences that we went through. So in that regard, it was preordained or it was planned. There were many talks and conversations about quote-unquote making it. There were many talks and conversations about, with all bands in London, that once you cracked England and possibly Germany, you would fly transatlantic to America, which was where you quote-unquote made it. And so, yeah, in that regard, it was planned. And, you know, of course, nothing succeeds like a plan, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you have a plan, all you have to do is execute it. Mm-hmm. I mean, Miles, his personal plan as our manager was, God damn it, I'm going to be a millionaire by the time I'm 30. You know, well, being a millionaire in those days was quite a big deal. Mm-hmm. In point of fact, he never made millionaire status till he was 40, but at least he had a plan.
So, since we were talking just a moment about the being on the road so much, was that part of Copeland's plan as well, to have you guys out there, get you in front of as many people as possible so you would resonate?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. The wheels come full circle now because, you know, really the music business has been just so decimated for rock that whatever level you're on, whether you're a big band, whether you're, you know, an Iron Maiden, or you're a Wishbone Ash, you have to be on the road now. And that's the way it was back then. It was, you know, it was really, we only had magazines and FM radio. So if you wanted to be seen or heard, you had to be in the town where that FM radio station was, call in at the radio station, do an interview, then swing over to the pressing plant where they were making up your albums, and then be on the road and just blanket cover the United States or whichever country you happen to be in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what the plan was. It was a very brutal kind of, you know, there was nothing particularly clever about it. And kind of, it's funny because now for young bands, you know, or even older bands, I mean, it really, the focus of action is on the road again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that has always been a constant in my life. That's why I'd be nuts to try and fight it, because that's where I go to make my bread and butter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Well, yeah, you're right. Everything is full circle. It's just that you've always been on the road, so it really is not a bone of contention.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I mean, there've been times when we've been out of sync with the music game, but you know, there are times like right now where people, I mean, I get it time and time again with bands, young and old. They the one thing they respect is that kind of that work ethic, that road ethic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that all players realize that that's really where the action is. That's where you get your chops together. That's where you work out any kind of personality glitches in a band. That's when a band is a band, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't be a band unless you are actually out there flexing your muscles.
Mm-hmm. No, for sure, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, yeah, I totally agree with you. You know, it's funny, you know, many people pinned you guys as progressive rock, and I, you know, and yeah, I suppose, you know, some of the subject matter in the lyrics, definitely some of the vocal lines, some of the chord, yep, the chord changes. But when, more often than not, when I heard your guitar playing, the leads that you were playing on top, there was a lot more blues underpinning and jazz lines being played across those chords than, you know, what is considered a progressive, you know,
right.
or what, you know, what people, you know,
right.
put that is.
Right.
So what was your background? I had read somewhere that early on you were inspired by Django Reinhardt.
Really, in my teens, my dad turned me on to Django Reinhardt, and it was that gypsy jazz that really fueled my interest. I could just hear the passion in that music, and that most definitely the lyricism in his playing and his attack, the kind of frenetic stuff, French gypsy style. You know, I didn't try to emulate it, but I tried to tap into that kind of energy. That was really what excited me, and I think that, you know, when you talk about progressive rock, to me it's a little bit. I like prog rock, you know. I mean, there's lots of it that I like, and I like the jam scene right now. But some of it's kind of unsexy, and that's the thing that the blues element brings into rock. It brings sex into it, you know, kind of sexiness in the playing, which I think that. You know, blue, I would say that, you know, my roots really are folk blues. You know, I love folk and I love blues. And then as you just described, you layer that into maybe some progressive rock elements. You know, you really come up with the sound of Wishbone Ash. And you know, don't forget when we came of age, we had a big blues boom in the United Kingdom in the mid '60s.
Yeah.
So all of the American blues artists that couldn't get arrested in the States were coming to London, and they were playing on these festivals and in the colleges and the universities. People, you know, Lead Belly. I mean, we had, you know, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf. All these guys, you know, were coming over to London, and that fueled the blues boom. Well, after that, you know, we went through psychedelia, and then turn of the decade. Bands were thinking, okay, we like the blues format, let's build on that, but let's take that blues and infuse it into something a little bit more adventurous. And so you had the birth of bands like Yes, Genesis, Jethro Tull, Wishbone Ash, and that's where I'm coming from. That's how my roots, you know, that's the line, that's the way it works.
Right.
And, so I think you're absolutely right, and I think the thing that perhaps takes us, what makes us a bit different from, say, a band like Genesis, is you've got that kind of sexy guitar, or two guitars, in point of fact.
Right.
We're a twin lead band.
Right.
You know, which gives it that kind of, that intrigue that a lot of guitar players like.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing is, you know, I was listening to a bunch of older recordings, and you guys really were on the cutting edge in regards to, you were one of the first jam bands before there were jam bands. In some respects,
you're absolutely right. You know, because we were learning our craft, and we would go around the clubs, and you know, we would just start to play. There were in the early days, I mean, we didn't have enough material to do a couple of sets a night or whatever, so we'd extend the songs and we jam them out, and you know, we were just like really just getting off on playing, like, and. And so, in many respects, we were an early jam band in many respects. And you know, we still love to do that. I love to do that. I love to just cast off the shackles and just let rip. And I think that, you know, I think that's also part of the roots of this band and the roots of my playing.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, when you talked about some of the other contemporaries like Yes and Genesis and Crimson. You know,
yep.
and bands
structured.
Like, yeah, very structured, and not that it wasn't good, but it wasn't emotional. It wasn't
exactly.
Yeah, yep. there was you, but you fused that whole thing of, yeah, it's got this,
yeah.
It's got this progressive background, but on top, it was quite a layer cake. Really interesting.
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, the thing is, speaking for myself, you know, the whole of my teens was spent, you know, I started out playing like surf guitar, really. I mean, that
wow.
Instrumental rock. And then I moved into, you know, I discovered Chuck Berry, and then I played in what we called in Britain soul bands.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to emulate as a guitar player and being in a band. Most of the bands were bigger bands with horns and Hammond organ, and we just fell in love with the whole Stax, Motown, Muscle Shoals thing, you know. And so from an early age, that also was part of my roots. So when you sort of bring that into progressive elements, or you know, a four-piece rock band that was not afraid to dip into jazz or extended pieces, you know, that's also, you know, how you end up with the sound of a band like Wishbone Ash.
Yeah.
That's the way it came about.
Yeah, for sure. It's good to wear your influences on your sleeve, as long as something more original comes out of it, and that's I think what
exactly
happened.
And you know, I think, as I said earlier, every band was looking for their own unique sound. And I can actually remember specifically when we stumbled on this twin lead thing. There were a couple of bands dabbling in it with it, but we just took it further.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember the thrill of that. You know, every time we would, again, we were actually using the guitars rather like horn lines in a bigger band. You know, you'd have these grooves and these rhythmic patterns, and then every once in a while you'd be punctuating the music with, you know, twin lead lines, which were like horn set. It's like a horn section, you know, really.
Yeah.
And I think that hit on a trigger for a lot of people. They got it. You know, they could understand that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, it's true what I said in the beginning, that, you know, especially the British bands, because you were really, you know, hometown band. They were noticing you. Bands like Iron Maiden definitely nicked that idea. And I think
that some of the guys in those bands, like Iron Maiden, Big Country, even U2, they were the next generation down. You know, they're probably 5 years younger than myself, or maybe 9 years, 10 years younger than the older guys in our band. And they definitely would have been in the audience at some of our early shows. I mean, we were touring Britain when, you know, England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales were quite separate. And it was a really big deal for a London band to go up to Scotland and play Edinburgh, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, it's nothing. But you would go up there and you were really going to the provinces as far as music was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And you were taking these exotic guitars and this music that was this kind of mishmash of lots of interesting elements, and playing in the town halls in Edinburgh, Glasgow, Dublin, Belfast, Newcastle. I mean, this is quite a big deal. There were only a handful of bands doing that at the time. Free was one of them, Mott the Hoople. I can remember being on the road with those guys, and it was a really big deal when you pulled into, you know, they were major cities in Britain, but in rock terms, they were quite provincial, and these crowds would just go crazy for this music.
Mm-hmm.
And so they got the sound, they got the element, they got all of it. And, you know, it was very impactful, and that's what gave us the feeling that we were onto something. You know, we felt that we'd discovered our sound in rehearsal rooms. We were very excited about what we were writing, and but, you know, when we actually went out there and tested the waters with these audiences in Britain, up and down the country, we realized we were really onto something.
Yeah. From a technique standpoint, did you have to, you and it was Ted, right?
Yeah, Ted Turner.
Yeah, when you and Ted sat down, did you guys have to sequester yourselves together and kind of work out the parts, or was it?
It was really a three-part process, because often we'd get to a point where we want to construct something, and we'd often sing it to each other first, and then we'd work it out on guitar, do it by ear, and sometimes Martin Turner, the bass player, would come in, and he would add some input as well. So, and then even what made our band interesting as well, that you would actually have a three-part element going on there, because the bass would often be working against the guitars, moving through the melodic sort of nature of the chord, or even joining the band, the two guitar players, and creating a third harmony. Because, you know, in America, bass that was forbidden territory for bass guitar. But in Britain, there's almost a tradition of bass guitarists going up the top of the fretboard and joining the guitars, mm-hmm. A la McCartney, a la Sting, a la, you know,
Phil Lynott,
the greatest of all, Chris Squire.
And Phil Lynott, even.
So, you know, it was quite normal for us to do that. So that enhanced the sound of the twin guitars even more, massively powerful. But, then there would be a period of just sitting down there and sequestering ourselves and working out those lines. We were learning our instruments too, so we were, we were getting benefit on all sides, really.
Yeah. I was recently speaking with Joel Danzig, formerly of Hammer Guitars.
Joel, an old friend.
Yeah, and he told me that we were talking about the up and coming of Hammer Guitars, and he was telling me what a boon it was, and the thing that really put Hammer on the map was the fact that you guys started using Hammer guitars, or you in particular. Yeah. You in particular.
Our bass guitarist, Martin Turner, was specifically using Hammer.
Uh-huh.
We were buying guitars from those guys, and I remember very well when they got off the ground and they were starting to make these great instruments, and all of that went in sync with our early touring days. Another figure was Larry DeMarcio. The pickups, pickups started to get a lot better, and a lot of things were just discarded in America that people didn't realize in the early 70s what fantastic stuff instruments were being created in the 50s. And so a lot of this stuff would just be languishing in pawn shops. And really, it was almost like bringing coals to Newcastle, as we say in England. It was almost like the way that we were impregnated by these old blues guys coming to England and then took it back to the States. And the same thing with the guitars. We were raiding pawn shops when we first started touring stage. And we would pick up, unbelievable collections of guitars. Yeah. Everything. I remember, going into shops, picking up, 1954 Stratocaster, $300.
Yeah.
1952 Telecaster, $300. There was this magical figure of $300. Everything was $300. And it was like, didn't matter whether it was a Les Paul, a Fender, or whatever it was, and a lot of players in this country were overlooking all this stuff.
Yeah,
a lot of the Japanese manufacturers were coming out with stuff, and people were wanting to buy that. But so now everyone gets it. Everyone gets the whole guitar collecting thing. They understand the evolution of the guitar. They understand the value of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a very, very exciting time for guitar manufacturers, fans, musicians. It was so underground. It was like our own private little club.
Yeah. So for you, it was the Flying V.
Yeah, Flying V. There were a couple of them imported into London in a particular store in Denmark Street, which is like the... in the Soho area of London, where all the musicians go, and I was down in the in a store there. It was called Orange. The people that manufactured mm-hmm. and marketed the Orange equipment,
mm-hmm.
and we were about to purchase our Orange backline, and they had two of these guitars, which were made in '67, and we're talking 1972 now. No one wanted this guitar. The Flying V was a dud, as far as everyone was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
It was too futuristic. It was too out there. I picked one of these things up. It was still in the packing case, 5-6 years old already. I played the thing, and I was like, whoa, this thing not only looks cool to me, it has a unique sound acoustically before I even plugged the guitar in. And I bought that, again, £300. Not $300, but £300. I bought that guitar, and that became my baby. And I remember that so well. And I still have that guitar. I still use it on occasion. I've always used Flying V's. I'm just very comfortable with the shape.
Mm-hmm.
And now, of course, the guitar is an iconic symbol of heavy metal, really. Whether it's Judas Priest or whether it's whoever it is.
Yeah.
If you're a metal player, the V is, that's all powerful.
That's right.
But, I'm not really a metal player, but I do understand the lineage. I understand, you know, I met Michael Schenker, Rudolf Schenker, these guys are V players. They came to our shows back in the early days. Mm-hmm. I sold those guys guitars. They know the deal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they took it on. They took it on to another level. And it is a very exciting stage guitar.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I played them for years.
Have you?
Oh, yeah. And they were Hamers. I always played Hamers.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, they got it. I mean, you know, Joel and Paul Hamer, they totally got the V concept before it was popular. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, actually, the first one they ever built was the one that Joel built first was a Hamer. It wasn't even Hamer yet at that point. It was a Flying V bass because he was a bass player.
Is that right?
Yeah. So I wanted to talk about your sound, your tone.
Sure. Yeah.
The thing that I noticed, you know, when you hear, it's so interesting because, and it was amazing because Ted sounded completely different than you did. And, you know, he favored Strats a lot, and
yeah.
and you with the humbuckers,
yeah.
But the sound when you guys were together was beautiful. It was perfect. It worked perfectly, but you could always tell who was taking a lead. Not just from the voicing, not just from the phrasing.
That was important. Yeah.
Yeah, but the tone was really distinctive. What was your rig like then, for you to get the sound? And is it the same now? Because you sound the same, and you still sound as good.
Thank you. Well, the rig was really in two parts. There was the studio rig, and there was the live stage rig, and the live stage rig could have been anything from early high watts initially, Laney, and then I ended up with the orange gear, you know, the OR100s, and I was always looking for a clean sound on stage. I mean, it needed sustain, but I wanted to be able to chord clearly and to in order to get the guitar to sing, basically the way we would all players would play in those days, because there were no effects in those days. The only effect maybe was reverb. So we would crank the amps up, but you know, be very, very judicious with the use of the volume pot and the tone pot on the guitar. Mm-hmm. So there's a different approach now, because these days guitar players, they're not really interested in the tone pot. They pretty much use a guitar between 8 and 10, generally 10. And if you want to just get it to sing a bit more, you use a stomp box.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't like that in those days. So, you know, but I always wanted clarity in the guitar sound. And but then in the studio, I would like use a little bit more breakup, because the studio environment was often a lot drier than a hall or an auditorium. So, you know, I would use, typically my studio rig was two Fender concert amps, the old brown, tweedy-looking ones from the, I think, maybe the early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And those would feature Jensen speakers. I'd use two of them with 4x10s. And, you know, they would break up a little earlier, a little sooner on the dial, and I would use that as my, that was my recording setup on quite a lot of the early albums. So, you know, it was a two-part system. I mean, obviously, in those days, the PAs weren't as powerful. You had a lot more volume coming from the back line on stage than what bands use these days, because the PAs are now so much more efficient.
Right.
So you needed a big, powerful, clean-sounding rig. And I mean, in the States, I would use two of these 100-watt orange amps, which were clean. And then I would even refit the cabinets with JBL K120s, which were super clean speaker, hi-fi speaker, really. And I even went up to two 200-watt orange mat amps by the time we got up to some of the bigger auditoriums. So massive power on stage, clean power, you know, take the top of your head off. I mean, it was really, really
yeah, it must have been so loud on stage.
It was unbelievable. I mean, you know, and it wasn't a Marshall distorted sound. It was a bright, clean, clangy, really mid-range, punchy sound that would carry out right into the auditorium. So, like I say, you didn't need much miking of the amplifiers. And the bass rig, too, was almost like a miniature PA system on stage, either side of the drum set. So we were really loud on stage. But, you know, over time, that has changed. And now my stage rig is almost now like that early 70s studio rig. So I'm using on stage, well, I've used for many years now, just a couple of amps, the same Fender amps, just like I would use in the studio. But I use now Fender Pro Sonics, which is actually discontinued amplifier, but again featuring the 10-inch speakers, and then I mic those up and monitor them clearly, and I do use effects pedals now.
Ah, what are you using?
Well, my favorite overdrive pedal is Analog Man King of Tone. I use that. Fortunately, Mike Piera, the owner of the company, is a neighbor of mine, so I can go down there and just fiddle about his workshop. And you know, I've become a big fan of his sound. But what is interesting is that he has the same ethos as I do, in that, you know, if you are going to bring in overdrive and distortion, it's got to be transparent. You still got to hear the actual, you got to be able to hear all the voicings when you're playing the guitar, you know, the pick sound, the expression. And so even though we're using these pedals, it's still the same concept, you know, that if you're playing lead, it's got to be clean. I don't know, it's quite a compliment when you say my sound has remained consistent, because there's been quite a shift, as I've just described, in the way that we would achieve a stage sound then compared to how we would achieve a stage sound now. But it's just mutated, but it's kind of kept this equilibrium all the way through. Well, so, you know, that's quite a feat if I think about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was going to be my next question, actually, is that how the heck did you do that?
Well, I think that's where the ears come into play. You know, I mean, I hear guitar in a certain way.
Right.
And I feel it in my arms and my body when I'm playing it.
Right.
And, you know, like, as I describe with the Flying V, I mean, with the Flying V, before you even plug the guitar into an amplifier, this thing, there's a lot of body, there's a lot of wood in the body, and it vibrates into your stomach when you're holding it. You feel the thing and you tune into that, and you're looking to resonate, get that guitar to resonate with what you're putting down. So, yeah, there's a lot of that. I mean, in my book, I actually even put some people probably read my quote there and think it's a bit bizarre, but for me, when I was a kid growing up, a lot of guys in our street and in the neighborhood would whistle. You know, merchants and traders would walk down the street whistling. Guys don't do that anymore, but that, to me, is like when you start whistling as a kid, you tune into that with a whistle. You can whistle a melody, and it's a bit like that with a guitar. You're looking to kind of get that guitar to sing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I put a lot of power into the guitar with my arm and my fingertips, you know, and I'm plucking those strings. I'm doing everything I can to get that piece of wood and metal and everything to resonate. And then if the amplifier's a good amplifier and it's clean, it will pick up on that, and it will project that sound that you're pushing into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's always been my, you know, that's a starting point for me. You know, I'm not really into, how can I put it? I'm not really into just relying on some fuzz box or something to give me some kind of distortion. It really has to come from the heart and the arm and the body. You have to force it through that piece of wood, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense?
Absolutely, yeah. I've said this before on the show. Billy Gibbons calls it meat on metal on wood.
He's dead right. It's exactly right. I mean, you can hear some of the younger players, the very muscular players, since Stevie Ray Vaughan, people like Joe Bonamassa are employing this now. They've figured it out.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I've been doing it all along. I think, you know, like Billy Gibbons, same thing. You know, you just know how to make that, meat on metal on wood, make all those components gel together, and bingo, there comes your sound, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you, it's amazing to me that it's like nothing has changed. So that's...
Yeah, it's absolutely right. I mean, you know, the wheels come full circle. I mean, like, the electric, electric guitar has not progressed hardly one iota since the 50s.
Yeah, I mean,
it's the same components, the same construction. In fact, all the modern players, guitar makers, they're trying to figure out the mojo of these early instruments. And what it is, actually, is the fact that when early manufacturing came in the United States, you know, the 50s was a perfect blend of hand finishing, hand curing, but early automation, you know, in the mass production. But we were coming out of the era of, you know, luthiers and handmade instruments. And so, you know, the way people were hearing music and hearing the guitar, you know, they might have been made, say a 45-year-old guy was building a guitar in 1952, he would have grown up in the jazz era. He would have heard those big F-hole guitars. He would have. That would have been what he would aspire to in making a solid-bodied electric. So he was looking for a lot of wood, a lot of warmth, a lot of, which was hard to get with a metallic-sounding electric guitar. But that's what he would have aspired to in making those instruments. So that's why all those 50s and 60s instruments are so woody-sounding. They just sound so warm.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
That's my theory.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think there's a lot to be, you know, you mentioned curing. You know, I think there's a lot to be said when a piece of wood dries out really well, and Chris, you know,
it becomes. Yeah, well, I mean, they took their time over that stuff in those days. I mean, you know, I mean, I've had guitars made by luthiers, and you know, they're very pretty. You know, I've had guys take me up in their attics and show me these pieces of Honduras mahogany that have been sitting up there for 30 years, and like, hey, one day I'm going to pull that thing down. It's going to make a great guitar out of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was more time for all of that back in those days. Now, nowadays, things are, you know, they're quick dried and, you know, all of that. You know, it's that soul that goes into the making of an instrument. And as I say, you know, they still were kind of keeping some of that on board in the 50s because they were coming out of an era where they really understood the properties of wood. They understood, you know, the way it should be respected and put together and all the rest of it. So, you know, I think that's my theory anyway.
Yeah, I agree with you. The V that you're using now, is it stock?
No, I have a... One thing I'm doing on my guitars quite a bit, and I nicked this idea from Pete Townsend, is I'm putting a piezo pickup on the bridge. So I'm actually... the guitar's fairly stock. You know, I use humbuckers, but they happen to be made in Germany by a guy called Andreas Kloppmann, who's a good pickup maker and makes transparent sound in humbuckers, much like the old, the late 50s Gibson ones. But, you know, I'm using this piezo pickup on the bridge, which enables me to feed that signal in with the electric sound and gives me these real crystalline, almost acoustic highs. So I can, that's a little trick that I've been doing quite a lot lately, and it's great for rhythm, for picking, and on clean leads I can filter that in a little bit. It's just a little kind of subliminal thing that I can add into the sound of the magnetic humbuckers.
Yeah, and the
so other than that, the guitar's fairly stock.
Yeah. So the piezo is going right direct into the board?
No, that runs through a separate channel and is going to...
It's going to an amp on stage?
I used to run it through an acoustic amp, but now I just run it direct into the... comes back at me through the monitors.
Oh, okay.
And so I blend it with the sounds coming from behind me, the magnetics.
And, that's pretty cool.
But the sound guy's totally hip to the way I use it, and he'll blend it and enhance it in with my sound as and when it's needed.
That's pretty cool. That's a great little trick. I want to try that.
It's very cool. It's so cool because, you know, again, as I mentioned earlier, I've always been a fan of clean, especially in the rhythm sound. I want people to hear what I'm playing, what I'm plucking out, you know, on the strings, and that enables me to do it. And people come up and they go, whoa, that is amazing, you know, because you've still got all the warmth of the magnetics, but again, you get this nice attack. Almost like an acoustic guitar attack mixed in with it. I wouldn't use that on heavy electric lead work. It's not appropriate.
Right.
But when I'm vamping or I'm playing rhythm or whatever, or I'm picking, it's very good for that.
Oh, that's cool. It must sound great with arpeggios.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you guys are, it's so silly for me to say this, you guys are on tour.
We will be in January. Yeah, we've okay. got about 2.5 month tour of Europe.
Excellent. And there's a DVD out now.
Yeah, we were in Paris earlier this spring of 2015, and we spent 3 nights in a theater called Le Triton, T-R-I-T-O-N, in Paris, and we recorded a DVD over those 3 nights, and that is on release currently.
Cool. And then there's a box set.
Yeah, we produced a budget live box set, 4 CDs.
Mm-hmm.
We record pretty much everything we do. And over the period of the last couple of 3 years, we've released these live recordings, really, for the people that everybody wants to hear live recordings of bands, and particularly Wishbone Ash, because we're known as a live band, and
mm-hmm.
they know that no two shows will be alike.
Mm-hmm.
And so we recorded these, and we put them out for the fans over the last couple of years, but now we've put them all together in a nice little box set. It's a budget box set. So I don't think it costs more than $20, but it's a lot of listening time for 4 CDs.
Yeah.
So and that's recorded in 4 different venues. One I think is in Germany, Hamburg. One is in the north of England at a fan club convention. Yeah, all kinds of different places, and yeah, it's really really good. It's an exciting project for us.
And there's playing on there for sure.
A lot of playing, a lot of guitar.
So, after all these years of doing this and having a guitar in your hand, what do you think you've learned the most after all this time?
Well, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Mm-hmm. I guess that's what I've learned. I don't think when I'm doing things right, I don't think it's the approach is different than when I first started as a teenager. How can I put it? I think that a lot of guitar players pick up the guitar sometimes because they're a bit shy, or they figure that they don't want to be a singer. so the guitar is their voice. And I think that when I picked up the guitar, I realized I could make music through my hands, you know, without having to actually sing. No, these days, of course, I sing. Mm-hmm. A lot more. I'm a lead singer now. I've become by default a lead singer, but and I do enjoy singing immensely. But I think a lot of guitar players pick that thing up, and it's still the same for me as it was back then. For me, I think it was a passion. It was something that came from my soul and my heart, and I think it still is. And I think that the more I can keep tuned into that, then the more I'm doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's got to have soul. It's got to, you know, it's got to connect emotionally.
Mm-hmm. Well, I heard it then, and I hear it now. You definitely have soul.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, Mark. Thank
yeah,
you.
It's great. You truly are, you know, and it's funny because, you know, people say, oh, they're progressive rock pioneers. You really are, you know, in many ways, you're a pioneer to a lot of other genres at this point. You know, the whole two guitar lead thing and the jam thing. And, you know, you were an architect for that period. And that's kind of cool. I mean, not a lot of people can say that. I think that's pretty cool.
It was by default, though, because, as I said earlier, or I hinted at, we, you know, when you talk about genres, there wasn't so much of that in the early 70s. It was really, you know, we didn't get too specific with, you know, labels.
Mm-hmm.
The term progressive rock wasn't even in existence.
Mm-hmm.
So Wishbone has always been eclectic in its musical the styles that we dip into, you know, much like a jam band now.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, there was a massive amount of freedom. So, you know, I'm happy that you say that, but it's by virtue of the time that I came up in as well. You know, that has to be credited as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll tell you, this has been a trip for me to talk to you because I have been listening to you for a really long time. And it's funny, I got turned on to you guys two ways. First, I saw an ad, a Hamer ad, actually, and I think it was in Guitar Player magazine. And then from there, I was like, oh, wow, this is cool. What's this all about? And then I saw you on Rock Concert. I think it was Don Kirshner's Rock Concert.
Oh, my goodness. Now you're going back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was cool. I was like, wow, this is wild. And I had never heard that before.
Something different, yeah.
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 So it was that's how long I've known about you guys, and it's
that's amazing. Yeah, not many people say that. No. I don't know that. Like, you're going back 40 plus years.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Well, I'm an oldster, so.
Thank you. That's nice to hear.
Well, Andy, this has been great to talk to you, and I want to thank you so much for being on Guitar Radio Show.
My pleasure, Mark. Good talking.
Great. Hold on 1 second, but we're going to sign off right here. Well, there you have it, folks. Thank you, Andy Powell, for being on the show. Folks, go check out this book, Eyes Wide Open. Really great. It's a great read, and it gives you a whole another insight to what was going on at that time. In that period of music. Really amazing. Really great interview, too. That was so much fun to do. Folks, we got to get out of here, but don't forget guitarradioshow.com, guitarradioshow@gmail.com, Facebook, Twitter, all the rest. You know that stuff. We got to get going, but in the meantime, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, keep on playing, and buy it. Don't steal it, okay? We'll see you on the next episode of Guitar Radio Show. Peace.
Now everybody say, F you, Ed.
I like this crowd already.
GRS Productions.